Cliffcentral.
The revolution.
I've got something important to tell you.
Cliffcentral.com.
Welcome to the Renegade Reports. Ramon, how are you doing?
Oh, very well, thank you. Our first post-election Renegade Reports recording.
Yeah, and I'm coming to you quite fresh, actually.
Yes, if you listen to this tonight, we recorded this afternoon, because we are well precise. And
well precise. It's us, we're well precise, but not very good at English. The elections were interesting. I mean, there were some... good predictions. That polling we thought might not be correct was correct on a lot of things.
I know, awkward. We did a whole show on why polling is not great. And then this polling is great.
Yeah, so we don't know yet what's happening coalition-wise.
Does anyone know? I see EFF is releasing the decision tomorrow. I mean, I can only foresee a DA-EFF coalition in the major metros. I don't see the ANC cracking the invite there, I must be honest.
Well, at least they got the ARC, you know. They stole their colors. They stole pretty much everything from them. Now they're back together, you know. So everyone's a happy family.
Yeah, they're back together. I don't, in which metro? I forgot. Something small.
I think it was Kurileni, which might give them the majority there.
But the most important thing about this election was not about policy, really. It was about what message the people voted for.
Well, which the ANC NEC decided to ignore completely.
No, but the message about the how the messages prior to the election of the ANC was, you know, why Monopoly Capital, Wit Gevaar, why people are racist.
Yeah, the racial sort of campaigning that EFF
was about land and colonialism and decolonization. And then ANC lost 10%, EFF won 2% or gained 2%. Like, all right. So most voters do not care about those. Not policy.
So Twitter's not real life.
I can't believe it.
Oh, I'm so devastated.
I can't believe it. The race war is postponed once again, much to the chagrin of some people on Twitter.
That brings us straight into our guest this week. Our guest might be known to some of you. We'll chat to him about how he was challenging for the mayoral position on the DA ticket in Joburg. He is Professor Rabelani Dagada. He's an author. He's an associate professor, telling me that he lectures at Wits and Voltec.
Yes, yes.
He's also a PhD in information systems and a fellow at the Institute of Race Relations. So if I can hit the board properly, welcome to the show, Rabelani.
Thank you very much.
Can call you Rabelani?
Yes, please.
Okay, great. So... I know Ramon and yourself were having a bit of a chat off air before we started. I don't know the story about your life story, where you all started.
So why don't we just let's start right at the beginning, Rabelani. So I asked you a question about why do you like the market so much or capitalism so much, and then you gave a very interesting story about your youth. So let's start there.
No, it has much to do with how I grew up, that as an individual, you can do a lot to empower yourself without being too dependent or having feelings of entitlement. I mean, I was born in Alexandra way back in 1971, obviously long before the two of you were born. Mm. And then
that long.
Just before I had to go to school, there was a lot of violence in Johannesburg, and my father took us to Venda, so far in the rural areas, closer to Messina. But unfortunately, my dad died when I was 9 years old. And really, I mean, I was, previously chatting to my colleague here that nobody can claim that they've suffered in terms of poverty than me. So I know the worst. I mean, I went to school barefoot up to grade 10. Hmm. So only in grade 10 I started to put on shoes. And I walked to school, 6 kilometers to school, 6 kilometers back home. Sometimes it will be raining, no raincoat, no umbrella. And most of my schooling, not in classes, under trees. And there I learned something. I learned that anybody who's determined to make it in life can make it in life. And I saw my mom also working very hard for five of us.
Mm.
Now, then I learned an important lesson. You don't need a sugar daddy to make it in life. You don't need a government which behaves like a sugar daddy, which throws money to people. And because those people may not have that thirst, they may not work hard. Actually, that money, if you throw it to people, it may become counterproductive. I see it with my, I've got children.
Mm.
My son, I used to buy him all the gadgets he needed, and he'll break them until I said, no, you need to work for these gadgets. You need to search for them. Then he started to appreciate them. So because of all this background, I eventually naturally, I became, I opted for liberalism and capitalism than socialism.
So you are literally that story, that sort of African child, you know, who studies under a tree, who walks, you know, tens of kilometers a day to get an education. And why do you think it's become so controversial to use that word entitled, and to talk about hard work as a positive thing in sort of the colloquial discussion?
I think it's because since 1994 we've had, as I described earlier, a sugar daddy government, what these days we call a blesser, which throws money to people, which throws grants, which throws food parcels to people. And it works for this government because then the large part of population are dependent on them. They can't do, they can't imagine themselves without this blesser. So the moment you mention the words hard work, the words entitlement, then you are insulting some people. Actually, I suspect that this government actually like the fact that most of our people remain uneducated, because then they can express so many agendas, so many propagandas. I mean, like white monopoly capitalism, like the fact that a DA will bring back an apartheid government, and some people may start to believe these lies, because if large parts of population become educated, they'll be able to see through this propaganda, they'll be able to see through these lies.
Something I just want to add here. So, I mean, the grant system, I mean, it's not perfect by any means, but you do see some pragmatic ways why it exists. It's a stopgap measure. Well, that's the intention. You're supposed to be on grants for a certain amount of time until you can get a job or whatever the case might be. Unfortunately, it seems to be the only income some people make in areas, and that's where the problem lies.
Yes, I fully agree. So the grants should be temporary measure for somebody between when they're unemployed until they get a job. But it has become a permanent feature. Why? Because since 1994, unfortunately, this government has neglected education, you know. Actually, I mean, they if you go to schools, kids are learning what they call mathematics literacy.
Yeah, math lit.
Math literacy. That's not real mathematics. And they're doing an English second language. Again, that's highly improper. Because the best way you can empower people is through education. So I'm seated here. I'm highly empowered. I mean, I live like a king, I can say that, because of what I earn. You know, it has something to do with the fact that I got empowered through education. But you don't see the government driving that a lot. I mean, earlier on saying that you look at schools in Soweto, most of them are vacated, they're closed, they're vandalized. There's no political will to get those school performing and functioning properly. Actually, what the government is doing, they are almost trying to bring down all the best performing schools. I mean, you look at M. Isi Lusufi. He's fighting with schools in suburbs. He says they must admit kids from Tembisa and Soweto. But my question is, why doesn't he fix schools in Tembisa and Soweto? He needs to fix those schools. So what we are doing now, instead of empowering the people that the government described as previously disadvantaged, instead of empowering them through skills, through proper education, what we do, we are trying to take from those who are empowered, we take from them and we give to the so-called previously disempowered. So what we're going to have the society that is going down.
Yeah. So there does seem to be this thing where, firstly, with wealth, instead of creation of more wealth, we just go, all right, we have this amount and let's spread it around more. So instead of the, you know, it's communism, really. We've got some rich people, some poor people. Make the rich people a lot less rich, or make them poor, essentially, and so we'll slightly uplift the poor, but essentially we'll just have a poor country. That's the one thing we do. The other thing that seems to happen, and I agree with you on the education, is instead of trying to rise up, so as you point out, get that school in Soweto, Tembisa, functioning at the highest possible level, we bring things to the lowest common denominator.
Yes.
So I think a lot of listeners would probably agree that things like pass rates for matric, instead of when kids weren't doing well and we had problems in schooling, instead of saying, all right, let's try get them up to the right level, we changed a pass mark from 50% to 30%. Is that a governmental thing? Is that a union problem? We know SATU is an issue within the teaching landscape. Is it just a very difficult thing to do? I mean, is this something we have to turn around and go, well, apartheid left us with a legacy where education wasn't provided as well as it should have been? There's arguments both sides, but certainly the black population was not prioritized on any level. And is it just a mountain that's too difficult to climb? Where do we go?
There's no political will from the government to fix education, but also to empower people that they claim they want empowered. Mm. 22 years is fairly sufficient in terms of turning around education. I got educated during those 22 years.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm paid fairly well. It's easy for me to get a job. Mm. Now, if within those 22 years I was able to be educated, so many other people could have been educated, even the youngsters. But there's just no political will. There's no vision. I don't see vision. For example, you're talking about creation of new wealth. That's doable. We can create new wealth instead of distributing what we already have. But also, the land issue. We don't have to take land from white farmers and give it to black people. We have lots of communal land. I come from rural areas. Huge tracts of land that are not being used. Why can't, if we are serious about the land distribution, that's the land. Why remove Mr. Van Donner, who's helping us in terms of food security, remove it from his farm, put me, I know nothing about farming. Then we are all now disadvantaged. He's not farming, Mr. Van Donner. I'm not farming. The land is becoming, that farm is becoming underutilized. So we don't have a visionary a government, and to me that is very problematic. And you are a doctor. Look at health.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about national health insurance.
Yeah, we're all terrified.
Yes, why don't they fix public hospitals?
Yeah.
But there's also this narrative that for some, apartheid happened and whites benefited far more than black people benefited. So there is that the unearned privilege of white people in this country. So especially on Twitter, which obviously does not represent any large population in this country at all, but the theorists on Twitter say that all so-called white wealth is unearned, so they don't see a problem with taking it away because it was unearned through a system that empowered only whites. And what would you say about that? Because it's unearned, you could take it away.
No, the problem is that the moment you, that white wealth is useful for the whole country, not just for those white people who own that wealth. I'll give you an example. Those very rich white people are the biggest taxpayer. Indeed. So they pay tax. You know, I mean, it's like these elections. You hear everybody says we must put emphasis on the poor, as if we must forget about the middle class and the rich. But the moment we neglect the middle class and the rich, they'll leave this country and poverty will increase. So we need to cater for them. They're very important. So those white people, the biggest taxpayers, they've got foundations. I teach at Vets University. We've got lots of donations from those families. But also, if I were the president of this country or in the governing party, I would make use of the very white people to empower black people. But without disempowering white people, I'll give you an example. If I've got a job and I need an engineer at the city of Johannesburg, we are governing there, and I've got two possible candidates. One is a 58 years old white male, and the other one is a 22 year old black youngster. He has just graduated from Tshwane University of Technology, but I have to give one of them a job. I'm going to give the 50-year-old white male the engineering job. Why? Because the moment you give him a job, through his productivity, he'll create more jobs. He can even create 10 to 15 jobs. There are studies that show that. And when he creates more jobs, that youngster, black, 22-year-old, who graduated from Tshwane, now gets a job and get to learn from this white, experienced engineer. So that's how we must do empowerment. But if you say, oh, you are white, you are male, you are 58-year-old, and you take the 22-year-old one, what may happen is that department may shut down. If it's in a commercial sector, the company, its sustainability will be threatened. So the very job that you're giving him, you may not sustain that job. So I think that's what we need to do.
I think it's obvious to note, but it's not because he's black that the department will shut down. It's about experience,
yes,
of course, yes. And skills.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, so to me, you come across very much as a non-racialist. Like, race isn't something by which you think about life or how we go about life.
It's not a moral question.
So I think let's sort of start diving into the politics, because we've got a political system at the moment which I don't think targets specifically any one race. We do have certain policies, BEE and things like that. But overall, our constitution says that we're all equal and we're all free and the rest of that. However, We've got a, you said governing party instead of ruling party. I heard you correct yourself. We've got this governing party who have, over the past at least year or two, have very much fixated on the sort of race baiting that has gone on. And we were just discussing as we were starting that we don't think it's really worked as a strategy. What do you think the purpose from their perspective is of trying to push that agenda, and the problems that creates in our society, if any? I mean, do most people care?
You see, the reason why they do that is because, as I said, they're not visionary. They've failed to turn around this country. They could have done that. It's doable. This country is very rich. Naturally, it's very rich. Mm-hmm. We can do a lot. But they failed drastically to do that. So it's propaganda. And this propaganda will continue for some time. If something comes up positively between EFF and the DA, and they govern together, Tshwane and Johannesburg, I swear the reaction from the African National Congress will be that, ah, EFF, now you're governing with the white monopoly capitalists and all those things. But most people are becoming wise. They won't take it seriously. I hear people saying that ANC is going to become a rural party. No, it won't. It will die slowly because revolution starts in cities. So once the middle class and the professionals starts to move in terms of politically, moving to, for example, DA, the rural masses will start to follow. And actually, ANC know that. That's why they are worried about Johannesburg, because it has a huge psychological impact on the voter. So this propaganda of white versus black, they won't be able to sustain it.
Well, and as we just said, I mean, the electorate completely rejected that narrative as well. But so going back to race in a way, but more about jobs and skills, and especially around the new Fees Must Fall Reloaded that is coming up apparently soon. So you wrote a very perceptive column on skills shortage about a trip that you took, and the professors who went with you were all much older than you. You were the youngest one by far on that particular trip. And you said there were very few people able to replace those professors when they retire. These professors, you know, have been in the jobs for 30 years, 40 years, and there's no real proteges coming up to replace them. And you use that analogy to make a more... a point about our job market in general. There's a massive, massive skill shortage. But from our perspective, there's more than ever, there's people graduating every year. There's more graduates every year than I ever know. So why is there a skill shortage at the same time? It doesn't make sense to me.
I think it's because of, it goes with the experience. We have forced some of our very highly skilled people, experienced, we forced them into early retirement. Some of them, particularly farmers, we forced them out of the country. And that's the problem that we have. So, yes, indeed, we have youngsters who are graduating, but they need experienced people for hand-holding professionally. Now we can't have that. But the other big problem that we have is... I once wrote a piece, it was published by Politics Web, and there I addressed the black professionals, and the title was Being Black is Not a Commodity. And some of the things that I raised there is the fact that black professionals in particular, most of them never stay in a job and attain experience. So because there are very few black professionals in certain skills or certain sectors, the guy will go there, 8 months he has left, but he has not accumulated a lot of hands-on experience. That is a problem. So that person will never become a specialist. So that's why Tito Mboweni, the then governor of the Reserve Bank, he once said, I'm happy with my white Afrikaners. I give them a job, they stay in a job. They attain skills, they attain experience, they become specialists. So we're not producing specialists, and that's a big problem.
Yeah, and unfortunately the unions killed off internships. Due to minimum wage laws and labor laws now, internships are dead. So if you want to learn how to be an electrician, you can't go with a single electrician. You have to go to a firm of electricians. Hopefully they can afford your minimum wage internship salary as well. I mean, that's another factor that confounds this issue, unfortunately.
Yes, you see, because of the sugar daddy and blesser government mentality, we're actually already in skills crisis, but it'll get worse. Deputy President Cyril Ramaphosa have now appointed a team that is going to determine a minimum wage. But you know what will happen? At the back of their minds, and according to their propaganda, they're doing that for the black masses, for the previously disadvantaged. Actually, I once tweeted about criticizing this minimum wage. You don't know how I got insulted by black people. They think it's about them. No. That's the problem. What will happen is minimum wage will actually increase unemployment. I always give this example. If I take my car to a car wash once a week, with a tip I pay around 100 rands. But how about somebody who's unemployed? They're passing on my street. My car is parked outside. It's dirty. They say they see me outside working on my garden and request to wash my car. I'm not going to pay that person 100 rands. I'll say to them, the brush is mine, the soap, so many things that you're going to use. The water is mine. I'm prepared to pay you 20 rands, maybe with a tip 30 rands. But if that person agrees and washes the car, my neighbor may say, hey, Rabelani, the guy who comes to your home every weekend to wash the car, can you also come to me? Then the guy now is making 60 rands, later on 90 rands, three homes now. But in the long term, he'll bring his brush, he'll bring his polish, he'll say, no, you, prof, you can't pay me 20 rands anymore, I'm using my brush. So the fee goes high. But he got a job now, and he's now a specialist. And eventually, after 2 years, in my neighborhood, he's going to open a car wash and employ other people. So that's how we created a job, because there was no minimum wage. So we paid him 20 rands. But out of that, it grew until he could even open his own car wash and even employ other people. But the moment you say the minimum rate to wash a car is 40 rands, I'm going to wash my car.
Yeah.
I'll wash my car personally. Then somebody is disadvantaged, and that's the problem.
So you deny access to the market. I think, you know, the point is it's a great analogy and an example. It's been proven again and again that minimum wage really does sort of stunt economic growth and access to jobs.
Yeah, well, it depends on the economy. Like, if you have a highly functional, skilled economy, minimum wage does make sense in a way, but not in a third world economy like us, especially a stagnant one. But the biggest problem with the minimum wage is that it makes voluntary contracts illegal. If I agree to work for you, Prof, for 1,000 rand a month, and we both agree, that's illegal now, which I find it odd in an economy where there are so few skilled people as well. That's the problem. Some people can't justify that minimum wage at all.
I think we should just let the market. Now, people say, oh, there's going to be abuse. Whether this minimum wage regime, which is legalized, there'll still be some people who abuse.
Yeah, they'll break the law. People break the law all the time.
And that's wrong.
And some of them are ANC MPs.
Oh, yes, of course they are. But it doesn't necessarily mean that there'll be large-scale abuse. Actually, they won't. Where I live, in the neighborhood where I live, I live in an estate, security, whatever estate.
Yeah.
Now, you are not going to pay your housekeeper who works full-time 3,000 rands. They won't stay. The guy next door will give them a job.
Yeah.
So the market there where I live kind of regulate how much we pay our housekeepers, which I think is a fairly good amount.
Yeah.
I mean, when you look at that sector.
Yeah, and well, that's the argument for the free market, really, and it works. All right, so on the free market, let's move back a little bit to elections. So let's go back to, I think it was last year, towards the end of last year, October or somewhere around there, I remember seeing. Ultimately, Herman Mashaba was the DA candidate for Joburg mayor. Who knows with all the negotiations that are going on, if he still might become the mayor, in fact. He's an interesting character, so you can tell us, I'm sure you know him relatively well, you can tell us a bit more about him, but I find him quite fascinating from the DA perspective in that I think he gave the DA a bit of a fright because he brings them back to their liberal roots, and he is really quite a truly classical liberal from what I can tell. Which I think scared the hell out of the DA. Shortly after he was nominated, he made some comments about, you know, Ramon, do you remember the exact
comment? It was BEE. He's like, I'm not black. My race doesn't define me. It shouldn't define, yeah. I don't see race.
And I think he also made a comment about social grants. Of course the DA is, let's not get to the DA just yet, but they are kind of stuck in this internal war between becoming more sort of social Democrats and, the other side, which pulls into a more liberal, classically liberal stance. But you were in a sort of race with Mr. Mashaba to be that candidate. So tell us a little bit about that. And
yes, I philosophically, in terms of political ideology, Herman and I are in the same camp.
Mm.
We are a little bit on the right of the DA. We believe in capitalism. We believe in free market, in liberalism.
Mm.
I mean, he occupied a senior position with the Free Market Foundation. I am a policy fellow with the South African Institute of Race Relations. So I think there was a lot of similarities between the two of us, the way in which we grew up. You know, I think Herman is what he is also because of how he grew up, how as a child to a single mom, you know, and also how he started working at a very younger age, you know, working for himself, empowering himself, you know, all those things. So yes, he was a successful candidate. I knew that would happen because he's highly more known, and I think the party took the right decision. You know, they needed somebody who's already known. It becomes much easier to make use of that person to campaign.
That's the political game, really.
Yes, yes. Yeah.
Mm. But would you have accepted a nomination to be the candidate if it was offered to you? For example, if he won, would you have been happy to prospectively be the new mayor?
Oh, yes, yes, I would.
Yeah.
And if you were, what policies would you employ in Joburg Metro now? If you had to have a 5-point plan, for example, what would you do?
One of the things would be just to look at the basics. Traffic lights. I mean, from where I live to M1, it's maybe around 3 kilometers. Sometimes I use 40 minutes, 3 kilometers from my home to M1. I mean, that can't be right, you know. So we need to look at that. And that's what frustrates business people, the professionals.
Mm.
You know, it frustrates them. When I go to Cape Town, I can't remember when I got a traffic light not functioning. But, you know, so one will look at those basics. But secondly, very importantly, is manufacturing. Since 1994, we are deindustrializing as the country, as an economy. Almost every month, a manufacturing firm is closing in this country. We need to go back to manufacturing. And people think when you talk manufacturing, it's outdated. And no, we still need that. If you look at economies like Germany, China, if you look at Singapore,
South Korea.
They're still doing some manufacturing. I think it's something that one will do, I mean, in terms of attracting investors. However, one will constantly be in collusion with the national government. You know, the national government, not intentionally, because of their laws, they were going to constantly sabotage one's plans in terms of reindustrializing the economy in Johannesburg through manufacturing. But it was one of the things that we were going to look at. And then you look also the inner city, very dirty.
I must admit, I go there quite often, and it has improved drastically in the past 5 years. I must be honest. I mean, kudos to Mr. Tao, Mayor Tao. I don't know how much of a hand he had to play in it, because a lot of private businesses have their own cleaning team, their own security team, their own everything, and they look after like blocks at a time. So BHP Billiton looks after a whole block, and it's brilliant. But it has improved quite a lot. But it's only 5 blocks out of I don't know how many hundreds.
We could still make it better. And then fourthly, public transport. We need to actually, we are far behind most of the cities in terms of public transport. Actually, you shudder to think how you'll survive a week without a car in Johannesburg. I think we need to do something in terms of public transport and also the levels of crime. So you need the JPMD must also start to get into that by just being visible rather than hiding behind bushes. You know, I think that will help.
So it's very essentially, you know, you in government would it's relatively basic things that that you would look to do. I've often argued that all people really want. I mean, Ramon's not a voter. I believe in voting.
I'm not a voter, but I still want what you're about to say.
Yeah. So thank you. So which is people just want this. People generally just want stuff to work. They don't really want politicians to interfere greatly in their lives and tell them how to live. But they do want to drive out of their house and, as you point out, have traffic lights work and the public transport's a great example. I still don't understand how. Certainly, we neglected areas like Soweto for the entire apartheid regime, essentially. But I'm confused as to how 20 years later it still might take a domestic worker who lives in Soweto 2 hours to get to the home she works in Sandton. That seems unacceptable, especially given that in my car I can do that same trip in kind of half an hour. We haven't addressed those kinds of small issues, which I think make huge differences in people's lives. I think those things are underestimated often by the politics of things. Would you agree with that?
Yes. It's also about why do people get into politics? And I mean, we're talking about Herman Mashaba. He says he's not a politician, but rather a people servant. I love that kind of attitude. By the way, if he becomes a mayor, they're going to pay him per year $1.2 million, which is far little than what he was earning in the private sector. But yet he's prepared to do that. Now, the problem with most people in the current governing party is that, truly speaking, most of them, they are there to empower themselves, to accumulate as much as possible. You were giving an example of a housekeeper who works in Sandton, but they live in Soweto. Look at the train situation, the rail situation. All the stories we hear about Plaza, in Transnet, where you have people there who are accumulating and stealing massively. That's the problem.
Because I don't have a problem with people enriching themselves, especially politics. In fact, I expect it. But if the outcome is good service from the state, I mean, we sort of let it go, right? I mean, if they were doing the job properly and what they had to do was being done, and they cream off whatever 5% at the top, like, okay, yes, it's part of the bureaucracy. We accept it. But here we've got only creaming off the top and no outcomes. Well, yes. not no outcomes. I mean, to be fair, there are some, but not to a degree we would expect.
The other day I was listening, I don't remember the name of the radio station, but somebody was saying, where in other countries, where a big bureaucrat in government, for every 10 rands, they will pocket 2 rands. 8 rands will go to the projects, but they'll take 2 rands. In South Africa, it's vice versa. For every 10 rands, they'll take 8 rands, and only 2 rands will go to serve the people. And I think that's the big problem.
Yeah. All right. So we now sit with the situation that we need some of the parties. They have to form a coalition. I don't really understand the full workings of the local government. I have tried to read up a little bit on it, but it is relatively complex in terms of, I thought it was quite complex in terms of the seats that each party holds and then what that actually means. Because coalitions, you know, you make a coalition today, it doesn't really mean much going forward, because at any point those seats can vote against you, and you know, there's all all kinds of ramifications in that sense. What do you think is the best possible outcome? We've got Nelson Mandela Bay certainly is up for grabs. I don't know if the DA's got enough to make it there without necessarily. I think the EFF is their big stumbling block because they are diametrically opposed as organizations. They may have enough to make a coalition there without the EFF. But Nelson Mandela Bay is up, Tshwane is up, Joburg's up. These are all places where the ANC could potentially lose the rule. So what do you think is the best sort of outcome that people could look forward to? That's assuming, I mean, if you're an ANC supporter, the best outcome is that the ANC gets into coalition with someone. But, you know, if you feel it's the other way around, what are your thoughts?
I think the best possible outcome will be for the DA and EFF to get into a partnership and form governments in Tshwane, Johannesburg, and Port Elizabeth, you know, because, but after that, psychologically, that will have a huge impact in the electorate, but also it will possibly be a rough ride, but I think the next elections, there'll be outright winner. The voters will give a precise mandate to a particular party, and possibly, I suppose I'm biased, possibly that will be the DA.
Because what I said about that coalition, which I like in a way, both parties can actually learn from each other in a way. So the EFF can become quite a professional organization quite quickly, because the DA is the most professional one in this regard. And the DA can dismiss those myths that they don't actually care about the poor, despite all the evidence in the world that most of the money in the Cape is going to poor areas. So I think they can both learn from each other. I just don't know how strong the will of the EFF is to actually run a municipality, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I've raised the point that my biggest concern is you go into a coalition and essentially with a party that has spent their time in government fighting. Whether you agree with those fights or not is really beside the point for me, because I can't see much achievement. So they made a lot of noise in Parliament, for example. There's a lot of noise and a lot of fights, and it's almost now, you know, the first time there was a fist fight in Parliament, we were all like, oh my goodness, there's a fist fight in our Parliament. And now it's kind of like, you know, this is like the way we now do business. And I'm just concerned that any coalition, and I'd say this as well for the ANC, I think if the ANC gets into bed with the EFF, which I do believe would be a nail in the coffin of the EFF, because I think their voters would be very displeased with that. I think they would deal with a DA coalition far better. But I just have concern that we see the same thing in the Gauteng legislature, for example, that we end up seeing, come budget time, the EFF kind of just shouting, making noise and arguing instead of just getting on with the business. And as entertaining as that might be, or even if they may have a point, at the end of the day, we just want a budget so that we can actually get guys on the street fixing traffic lights, metro police, policing, etc., etc. Opinions on whether they can actually behave?
Yes, I do have opinions, but I'm very hesitant to express myself. I understand negotiations between the DA and EFF are at a very delicate. They're very delicate.
Mm-hmm.
So. By the way, I should have mentioned the fact that I am the DA councillor elect. So I'll be sworn in possibly next week, Monday, when the mayor and the speaker gets elected. So I don't want to say anything here that will jeopardize.
We didn't know you were so embedded. This is a banned show. We should have had an EFF councillor and an ANC councillor.
In fairness, we've tried to invite the EFF on the show.
Jonathan, we have failed our listeners.
Yes.
No, we don't care about banners at all. We get whoever we want inside. Okay, so you have inner. So you got some information. We don't. Okay, so and I understand why you hesitate.
So I don't want to say something here.
Yeah, that comes back later and has negative. It's politics, basically.
Yes. But you say my point that the DA EFF coalition could actually be a force for good in the long run, And both parties could actually gain
agreed.
From it.
Do you have any idea, is the DA going to push for giving people title deeds in the new areas that they govern? Because I know that they've started to do that in the Cape.
No, but I can tell you, yes. In Johannesburg, within the very first 100 days, the mayor, Herman Mashaba, if he becomes a mayor, I've got no doubt, within the first 100 days, he'll issue some title deeds.
Well, I hope so, because, I mean, Alex, as an example, is one of the areas which is in dire need of giving people property rights.
It is just ripe for investment and wealth to be created in these places, but people can't because they don't own the land. It frustrates me no end that people cannot own the pieces of land they live on. And therefore, they cannot invest in it. They cannot get security against it. They don't. They can't. Like, it's just. There's just sunken drudgery.
But
in Alex all the time. It's like, just give them the title deeds and watch their place flourish without needing anything else. Just give them the title deeds.
But talking about title deeds and land ownership, it's going to get worse. I mean, we talk about the 2013 land. We talk about the 2013 Land Act. ANC is bringing the 2013 Land Act through the expropriation bill.
Right.
Remember, according to that bill, if Mr. Van Tonner loses the land is expropriated from them. Mm. It's given to me, Rabelang Dagada. I'm not going to own that land. It will be a lease of around 100 years. Maybe after 100 years, I may own that land. Now, what it means is my grandfather never owned land. My father never owned land. It also means I won't own land.
Neither will your children.
Yes. Oh, I said 100 years. No, I think it's a lease of around 50 years. But in 50 years' time, I'll be in the wheelchair or long dead. So I'm just saying that because Roman is talking about land ownership. But I'm saying the present government doesn't appear to be going to allow people to own land anytime soon. And the problem is that most of the laws that ANC come up with, they say they are doing that to advance and to empower black people. No, those laws are actually going to disadvantage the very black people that they say they're going to empower.
I mean, that's not a surprise. I mean, governments do that all over the world. But what do you think of land in general? I understand the emotional attachment to land. So the EFF does this quite well. It's about, well, sort of. But they have an emotional attachment. It's about the dignity of our people to have the land that where their ancestors lived on or their grandfathers lived on. And I accept that premise, not just as an emotional premise, not as an economic one or political one. But in general, do you think land reform is necessary? I mean, I think it is, but you just give people title deeds on the place they already live on. But in as a macro issue, do you think it is an issue for most people?
No. It is. Land reform is necessary, and I'll qualify my statement. It is necessary, but is it preoccupying the minds of most people? No. I mean, I work with the IRR, Institute of Race Relations. Most people, what they want is jobs. So they are moving from rural areas, coming to Johannesburg. What they want is to get employment opportunities and thereafter be able to buy a property and have a title deed for that property. Most people are not thinking of having a 20-hectare land for farming and all those things. Now, talking about land reform, I'm for land reform as long as you are not taking a farm that is functioning properly. You're taking it away from Mr. Van Tonner and give it to me. That is totally wrong. I'm against that. That's not how we create wealth. I'm saying the best we can do is for the so-called communal land. If you want to empower me by giving me land, give me that land that is not being used. Now, the argument that I get from ANC people is that that land is not arable land. That is not true. Where I come from, the land is so rich, and the micro farmers, they're doing very well. I mean, actually, at some point, President Zuma mentioned them. He mentioned an area around 180. That's where I come from. There are about 300 black farmers farming there, and they're doing very well. So it is not true that communal land is not arable.
But then again, I mean, the point of giving land is not for people to be farmers, right? I mean, not many people don't want to farm. If you look at land that has been given back, people do prefer the cash value of that land, not the land itself, which is a very legitimate reason, I would think. People don't want to farm, and it's perfectly fine. I don't expect them to farm either if they receive land. It's about owning something which, from which you can organize your life, invest in the business, get capital, mortgage it for something else. I mean, without property rights, very few other rights exist.
Yes.
All right. So let's, while we're talking about land and controversial land, you are quite a proponent of the only democracy in the Middle East. So if your ears perked up at that, that would be Israel. And it's not without faults. You can tell us a bit about that. But you're quite a fan of the country, I assume. Tell us a bit about your interest.
Yeah. Interestingly, you described Israel as the most kind of prefacing what you said. Is that the right English?
Yeah, it's fine.
Paraphrasing it, what you have said. That is the most thriving democracy in the Middle East. Actually, Israel is the best ever place you could be in the Middle East. And guess who told me that? Israeli Arabs. The Israeli Arabs who live in Israel, who are citizens in Israel. Some people will say you are, other Arabs tend to say to them they are second citizens in Israel, which according to my research, I mean, I went to Israel and I've talked to various people, talked to Arabs, talked to the Jews. I've read extensively. It is not true that they are second citizens, but they say to me, those are the Israeli Arabs. Even if we're second citizens, then we are far much better than all other Arabs elsewhere outside of Israel. They would rather be a second citizens, but get the first grade life in Israel. But much has been said about Israel, which is not true. For example, that Israel is an apartheid state. That's not true. Everybody there is treated equally. I mean, 26% of the citizens are Arabs, and about 21% of citizens are Arabs, and then 71% are Israeli Jews. They are treated equally. There are some differences. For example, they tend to go to different schools, but it is not forced. It is because of the culture and religion.
It's choice.
It's choice. Now, and it makes sense, practically it makes sense. So on a Friday, in that particular school that is predominantly Arab school, they'll be able to observe their prayers, whereas on a Saturday, the Jews, that particular school, they'll be able to observe Sabbath. So there's that. But it's not forced. It's because of choice. So the whole notion that Israel is an apartheid state, it's not true.
Yeah, it's gained a lot of traction. Certainly, with a lot of help in South Africa, we do have a lot of proponents of that argument here. I think important to note as well is to, and I don't want to be accused of sort of throwing in a red herring, but to look at places where there almost is apartheid. So if we look at, you know, places like Saudi Arabia, where they separate their men and women, for example, and women really are second class citizens. If we look at, countries like, you know, Iran, which used to actually be quite a free country once upon a time, but where they've expelled people of other religions, essentially. They're small pockets, here and there. But essentially, you're not really welcome if you're not, you know, a part of the larger population group. We've got, and it's a worldwide movement, this BDS movement. So they say, look, because I think it's important to say that, you know, for all the good that may happen in Israel and within the Israeli borders, if you're an Arab or a Jew or whatever, if you're an Israeli citizen, you live in a free democracy. You can be gay, you can be whatever, you can interracial marriage, you know, all these things that actually are frowned upon within the Middle East very often are perfectly fine in Israel. However, there is the issue around Gaza and the ongoing sort of, I suppose the only way to describe it is a conflict with the Palestinians. So what about the sort of argument there that the Israelis are committing a genocide and the Palestinians are completely, you know, oppressed by the sort of much more powerful Israeli force? What do you feel about that argument?
Actually, I visited Israel at the beginning of this year. I was amazed by the generosity of Israel towards the Palestinians, both in Gaza and the West Bank. For example, if you look at the border between Gaza and Egypt, Egypt has closed that border totally. Mm. So there's no movement of goods and people between Gaza and Egypt. And now, Gaza is occupied by Arabs, Egypt Arabs. So you would have thought an Arab state will be more friendlier towards Gaza, but it's total opposite. Now, the goods that goes to Gaza, they go via Israel. So Israel allow goods to from Europe. Some of them are donations and so many other things, construction goods and materials. They move through
Israeli border.
Israel border, which to me that's very important. And Israel supplies water to Gaza. Of course, they have to pay. Do they pay? Not really. So Israel does supply water and electricity to Gaza. What is even interesting, during a war when the two are fighting, Israel and Gaza, Israel continues to supply water and electricity. In some instances, Gaza militants will destroy water infrastructure. Israel will go and fix that. So I find Israel to be very, very generous, you know, but also most commentators and analysts tend to be very harsh towards Israel. I think there is a race element. For example, if somebody in Gaza or some people, militants in Gaza, attack Israelis and Israel has to revenge, they will run into a school. If Israel bombed that school, the outcry is so huge. But when you look at what those people did, they did even worse. So it is like, Israel, you are white. So we expect certain behavior and standards from you, moral behavior, than the Arabs. Nobody says that, but that's how I see it.
I completely agree with you. I do think there's a double standard in terms of it's moral relativism, in fact. It's a bit similar to the narrative here, where if you're black and poor, you can't do any wrong. Even if you destroy private property or whatever the case might be, you can do no wrong. And it's very similar in Israel, because I think because Israel is actually it's a constitutional democracy, or it's certainly a democracy. And I do find that people often use the term anti-Zionist as opposed to anti-Semite, because I mean anti-Semitism is wrong, but you can be against Israel. I'm still trying to find the definition. The two definitions of those words, because I think that they mean the same thing to a lot of people in their minds. For example, in the Olympics, a lot of Arab athletes refuse to shake the hands of the Israeli athletes,
or to compete against them,
or compete against them. If it was any other nationality or race or whatever the case might be, it would be deemed racist or something like that. But if it's against Israel, it's just they're fighting from they're fighting a system of oppression, so we sort of accept that. So I do find there's a double standard, and And let's not forget, I mean, Gaza is governed by Hamas, right?
Yes.
And the charge of Hamas is the destruction of Israel.
Yes.
So why would you expect them to get along?
Yes.
So let's talk about that quick, because, I mean, you've obviously got an interest. You've been there. Two-state solution, you still you think that's possible?
Yes, I do.
And the best solution?
Yes. I think there should be two-state solutions, but the greatest impediment to the two-state solutions are the Palestinians. I mean, the Hamas and Fatah, they are fighting amongst themselves. It's not Israel. But for the two-state solution to happen, we need strong leadership amongst the Palestinians. We don't have that. Not even in the West Bank. Mm. No, I mean, you have a leadership there that can't call its people to order when they're wrong. That can't condemn obvious acts of terrorism where people stab the Jews for no reason. So for the two-state solution to happen, you need strong leadership. There's no strong leadership that side. Look at South Africa. Nelson Mandela was a very strong leader, and that helped. He will say things that even to black people, his utterances were not popular at that point in time. For example, he said to the ANC, we can't continue with the armed struggle. It's not going to... We can't negotiate with F.W. de Klerk and his people whilst at the same time we are fighting with them. Let's stop the arms engagement. And that was not popular, but it happened. He was a strong leader. And at some point, he went overseas. When he came back to South Africa, he said, we are not going to, I want the right word, where you or nationalize the banks and the mines. We're not going to do that. At that point in time, that was not popular amongst black people and the ANC. But he said it, but in the long term, there were lots of benefits out of that. So you need something like that in the Palestinian side. A leader who says, no, this is wrong. We're not going to push the Israelis to the sea or to extinguish them. It won't happen.
Yeah, I think, Ramon, you listened to a podcast recently which gave a lot of the history around this. Perhaps a bit of background listening it would be useful for people who might be more interested.
Absolutely. So it's a shout-out to Daryl Cooper. He's an American chap, and he's got a podcast called Martyr Made. So it's MATYRMADE, one word. And it is a 12-hour-long podcast sliced into, I think, about 5 episodes. About the history of the creation of Israel, and it is absolutely fascinating. So, if you listen to that, you'll understand why the conflict arises today, and you'll know that it's actually purely political in the end. It's got nothing to do, very little to do with religion until quite recently.
Yeah, I think a lot of the more religious states like to kind of hop on the bandwagon and make it a religious thing.
Don't take my word, but anti-Semitism only came about in the Middle East after World War II. I mean, before that, Hitler is still seen as like some kind of hero in some areas of the Middle East for extinguishing Jews. But before then, it was purely political.
Yeah. All right. I think we've touched on a lot of topics there. Looking forward to next week. You'll be a counselor. Is that a first time thing?
No, actually, during the last 2.5 years, I've been a DA counselor in the city of Johannesburg.
Okay.
So this will be kind of a second term.
We missed that in your bio. Apologies, we didn't see that. Well, Rabelani, I mean, thank you for joining us. It was I enjoyed it. I hope you did too.
I did.
I hope the conversation was to your liking.
I did.
Yeah, right. Maybe we can have you back, and once things are underway with hopefully a coalition government, and when we can shout at you about things that aren't working.
and if you do take Johannesburg, this podcast needs a sponsor.
So City of Joburg.
We'll gladly do some tender work. We will, I don't know, you can hire us to do like outside broadcasts.
Nothing is below us.
We will take money from anyone.
Right. You can find Rabelani on Twitter. It's Rabelani_Dagada. He's also got his own website. That's rabadanidagada.co.za.
Yes, yes.
You can find him there. Does consulting work and also I think some speaking as well. So if you're interested in having him, please contact him. It's another show, Ramon.
Another show done. And yeah, this was great. Next one will be as great, we promise. Yeah.
Two PhDs in a row, though.
Can you believe it? Yes. So I think we had four in total.
Oh, did you go back and count?
Well, Michael Cardo, yeah. Franz Grenier,
yeah.
Ross Tucker.
And now Rabalani.
Now Rabalani.
Right. Thanks very much for listening. Renegade Report on Facebook, on Twitter, @Renegade_Report. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes if you're using our phones and Apple. Otherwise, we're available on the Cliff Central app, Pocket Casts. Tell your friends about it. Really get the word out there, and we will catch you next time. Thanks so much. Bye.
Cliff Central.
The revolution. I've got something important to tell you.
CliffCentral.com.